Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy to get 20% off your first month of cognitive behavioural therapy, with weekly sessions online with a therapist, in addition to worksheets, a journal, meditation and yoga videos, and unlimited messaging. There's strong evidence that CBT can help people who hoard, and accessing therapy online can be affordable and accessible. Find out more and get your discount at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/online-therapy.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. I am drowning in stuff and trying to find a way out. Listen as I explore the issues and delve deep as somebody profoundly affected by hoarding disorder. Find out more, including links to subscribe to the podcast and all of my social media at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. Finally, I am not a doctor. I am just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. Dr. Jan Eppingstall has a master's degree in counselling and a PhD in hoarding. As a counsellor in Australia, she works with people who hoard, and she has contributed to research about hoarding. She is a regular guest on the podcast, and it is always a pleasure to host her. Jan, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for that glowing introduction.
You're very welcome.
I'm very well today.
So, Jan, you spotted a research study that came to a really interesting conclusion, that experiencing childhood trauma might lead people to volunteer, donate money, or contact politicians about environmental issues later in life. And because you are fixated on hoarding, you made connections and thought this is relevant. So, researchers Raja and Carrico found that childhood trauma predicts both civic engagement and green behaviour. So, Jan, before we get onto how this applies to hoarding, can you first of all tell us a bit about this study?
Sure. I did stumble across this article and I did make connections that maybe others might not have seen, but I did stumble across an article that referenced this research recently, and I was interested in the finding because of the relationship between significant trauma histories and strong values around green behaviour. So Raja and Carrico wanted to know what drives environmental protection engagement, and found that childhood trauma experiences were more strongly linked to both public and private green behaviour. And when they were talking about public and private, public was about, you know, being an advocate, donating money, contacting your local MP, that kind of stuff. Private green behaviour was more around those actions that we take with recycling, using less water for showers, that type of thing. And the link of childhood trauma experiences was stronger than childhood experience related to nature and travel. So they tried to do this kind of study where they looked at, okay, what happened in your youth that led you to do these things? And they picked these three variables, and childhood trauma was the most relevant. I think the aversive nature of trauma makes it more deeply embedded in the memory. So I get why that might have occurred. Negative childhood experiences in nature and when travelling, like seeing devastation of bushfires in Australia or the dwindling habitats of orangutans, are traumatic, you know. So you'd be more likely to be influenced and engage in pro-environmental behaviours. So I do need to mention a couple of points about, or at least one point about this study and limitations, because one of my pet peeves was highlighted here. Your methods section should be comprehensive enough for a person to replicate your study. That's just the rules. Admittedly, I didn't dig super deep into the reference list, but the 8 items of childhood trauma in the Raja Karako study could have at least been listed so that I could see what type of trauma they were talking about here.
Sure.
So in essence, I was really interested in these, in the fact that kind of those happy memories of nature and travel, the relationship wasn't as significant as that childhood trauma. And yeah, but my pet peeve there, method section, I should be able to just go there and I should be able to just find that information out, because then I can see, is that relevant to my kind of ideas about trauma and the relationship to green behaviour.
Yeah, that's fair. So as we said, this research paper is not about hoarding, but it seemed to me that there were connections to hoarding in 2 main themes. First, a lot of hoarders have experienced childhood trauma. That's something we did a whole episode on. And second, a lot of hoarding behaviour is driven by, I'm going to qualify this, but it's driven by environmental concerns. Whether that is, the qualification is whether that is kind of effective or it is questionable. It feels like a motivator, whether it's an effective motivator or not. So could you talk a bit about what stood out to you in the study related to hoarding?
It got me thinking about the source of those strong environmental concerns, if that's what, yeah. I mean, if we're going to call it, it's a bit of a euphemism, but yeah, what is the source of that for people with significant hoarding behaviours? How might they come to the conclusions that they do about their belongings, consumption, waste, and the environment? And I kind of pondered that and I thought, well, if we look at some of the typical personality traits and lifestyle choices of people who hoard, we can kind of hypothesize a little bit. Those of us with significant trauma backgrounds often have, you know, fewer close relationships and are rightly suspicious and distrustful of people. People who hoard often live alone, have extreme shame, and are depressed about their circumstances. Perhaps there is a tendency for distrust to lead to less concerns for humans, especially if a person has suffered childhood interpersonal trauma, and more concern for the helpless, harmless creatures, living things. So I see it as kind of a kinship in suffering is one of my thoughts of how people make those kind of logical leaps to, I must protect the environment and those things that are helpless and harmless. The other thing is research shows that victims help similar victims and feel responsible for preventing suffering in similar others. So this could be that helpless, harmless, children, animals, living things and the environment, right? That it could be those are the similar others to us. It comes about from that kind of kinship in suffering, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. People who have experienced domestic abuse want to help people who've experienced domestic abuse. It's, yeah. So the study referenced a paper that talked about how some environmental activists are motivated by having experience of climate-related disasters, which ties into what you were saying, so hurricanes, floods. And it seems quite obvious to me how that kind of childhood trauma would lead to environmental activism. It's less obvious to me how other kinds of childhood trauma, grief, abuse, bullying would lead to environmental activism, even though this latest study has found exactly that. What do you make of that aspect of it?
The reason it's less obvious is because I think there's a missing link in this research. There's a missing variable. I mean, unfortunately, it didn't measure variables that might give us more of an idea regarding the causal nature of trauma and green behaviours, like empathy, compassion, charity, spirituality. Something's missing in there. And the other thing is, again, we don't know what the 8 significant adverse childhood experiences are. They could be natural disasters or abuse or grief. We can only guess based on related research. So I think it's because there is that missing link that they're using other research when they could have really added in some other variables in this case, in this research study, to kind of fill in the gaps.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there can also be a sense that childhood trauma can lead to increased empathy in a more wider sense. And if your childhood trauma has led you to mistrust people, then it's safer to advocate for the ocean or for blue whales or for elephants than it is to advocate for people who might let you down or hurt you or make your life difficult.
Exactly. Oh, exactly, because humans are fallible, and we have personalities and we make choices and decisions, etc. So we can certainly put one face forward, you know, to the public and then be behaving in another way behind closed doors, whereas an animal, you know, doesn't have that theory of mind, doesn't have that ability to let you down. Exactly. And I think that there is some of that. I know that this is a solid, you know, I'm supporting the whales because I know whales swim around and make whale noises. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to disappoint.
Yeah.
Definitely.
They're not going to eat me. Do you know, there was a Paralympian a few years ago who lost his leg saving his brother from a shark. So he saved his brother from a shark and the shark bit his leg off.
Mm.
And he became a Paralympic athlete. And then when he retired from athletics, dedicated his life to sharks. And I think that was partly because he just knew that the shark was being a shark. The shark didn't hate him. The shark was just being a shark.
Whereas humans, you know, they could be all sorts of things. Yeah. They could be an angel. They could be a shark. They could be, you know.
Yeah.
A piranha. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's really, yeah, that definitely highlights that. Because they don't have theory of mind and they can't change their mind or have opinions, etc., and do things that we don't expect. That's why we kind of like animals, even plants, you know.
And if your cat catches a mouse, it might be annoying, but it's just being a cat. It's not being cruel. Well, to be honest, they can be a bit cruel when they've caught it. But, you know, it's still just being a cat. It's not being mean.
Exactly.
And, yeah, and this guy had that with sharks, and good on him. I'll find a new story about it and put a link in the show notes because he's a really interesting guy. He just was, you would think he would hate sharks and be bitter for the rest of his life. But he just went, yeah, sharks are endangered. I'm going to help them, even though they'd literally eaten his leg.
Yeah, he's a better person than I, but, you know.
Absolutely. So there are plenty of examples of people turning their trauma into something constructive. People who set up charities to support others, people who campaign for changes in the law. So it's not a huge stretch to see that childhood trauma leads quite often to adults who care about the future of the world. And previous studies have found that trauma can lead to other pro-social behaviours, like volunteering. So it's not necessarily, it's not all environmentally related. There are thoughts that this is about empathy, trauma, increasing empathy, and this leads people to be more socially conscious in general. Does that fit with your understanding of the world?
Yes. Yes, it does. I mean, if we look at another study published last year, David Greenberg found that participants who had experienced a trauma event in childhood were more empathetic, and higher severity levels of the trauma correlated with higher empathy levels. So almost a, you know, dose response type situation. Additionally, Greenberg found that there was no effect of trauma on the social skills subscale of the empathy quotient. And he speculated that people who've experienced trauma might rely on internal resources rather than external social support from people around them. But perhaps it's not internal resources that they turn to, but animals, living things, possessions, right? It could be something completely outside of themselves, not that internal resource. As I said before, interpersonal trauma, you know, often leads to distrust of others. Unfortunately, Greenberg used a measure of childhood traumatic events. So it was sort of that traditional definition used to diagnose PTSD. So sort of almost individual shooting or, you know, a one event, an abuse event, etc. So it wasn't that kind of constant interpersonal trauma that we would probably see more likely in cases of hoarding.
Yeah, the cumulative stuff.
Cumulative stuff.
Yeah.
And he also didn't break out interpersonal trauma histories, which I think would have been very interesting and would, you know, potentially support my hypothesis. I think it would be a nice PhD thesis to investigate the kind of mediating or moderating effects of empathy on green behaviours in those, you know, experiencing trauma events compared to those without trauma histories in the hoarding population. So someone should do that. Off you go. I'd like you to trot off and do that now, because I'd like to know. I won't be doing it.
In 4 years' time, I would like you to tell me.
Tell me in 4 years' time. I can't guarantee a scholarship. But another article caught my eye too when I was going, was looking into this, was Tree Huggers versus Human Lovers, Anthropomorphism and Dehumanization Predict Valuing Nature Over Out Groups, which I found extremely interesting. Rotman and colleagues, this is a 2021 study, found that a third of participants were tree huggers. They like to call them that. I'm not sure how people who are passionate about the environment feel, but tree huggers ascribe greater moral worth to nature, animals and ecosystems over out groups, humans from marginalized or stigmatized groups. Found that fascinating. Tree huggers were more likely to attribute mental capabilities to animals, so that's your anthropomorphism, and were less likely to ascribe mental capabilities to out groups of all things.
Explain what out-groups are.
Out-groups are your marginalised, stigmatised groups. So okay, whether they be, you know, a racial, disability-related, any marginalised groups, I'm going, well, that was quite kind of probably not well-defined, so there's an issue with that. But they had elevated levels of anthropomorphism and dehumanisation, which is kind of really interesting given that they're kind of opposites.
Yes, it is.
No, no. I thought it was really weird.
It is. You would think increased empathy would be universal. Yeah, that is interesting.
So sort of a zero-sum situation. So if they were that animal kind of ecosystems tree-hugger person, then that meant that they didn't have any, didn't have enough empathy to kind of,
against racism and
worry about humans and racism and it's like, but I can kind of see it too in a way, you know, especially if you have had a traumatic background, it might be, well, humans have been pretty destructive to not only the environment but to my entire life, maybe there are people out there who are just not human and don't deserve my support. But it seems interesting that it's out-groups to me. I think that's really...
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, because I also have, you know, there is plenty of room in environmentalism. Well, in fact, it's vital that we say humans did this. Humans are what has caused this damage to the world. So I feel like some general hatred towards humans in general, if you're an environmentalist, yes, is probably not healthy, but is understandable. But it's, yeah, it's the fact that it's already marginalized groups of humans. That's where it doesn't quite.
I know. And I think there could be something there in how they've, you know, the methodology, and maybe there's, you know, some more digging into that that can be done, because I just thought that was really, really interesting. And the zero sum kind of aspect of it, you know, I can't have any empathy for these other people who really need, you know, really deserve it, but I'll give it all to, you know, animals and ecosystems and none to humans. Very interesting, I thought.
It is.
That was just a bit of a, you know, rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Moment.
What is the internet if not rabbit holes?
Correct. Correct. And I happily go down them.
Oh, same. 3 a.m. and you're reading the Wikipedia page for the rules of poker. Started off wondering how volcanoes worked at 11 p.m.
Exactly. And for me, like, I read, you know, I read a book and then I'll watch the movie. I'll Google the actors and then who they're, but you know, who are they playing and what is that based on? And oh my goodness, I do think there's some spectrum kind of behavior there, but that's okay.
The one of the more bewildering of those was one time I had taken a sleeping pill, and when I take a sleeping pill, I get kind of amnesia for that period, like afterwards. So when I wake up, I can't remember what happened for like the bit before I went to sleep. And I do not know why, but the page that was like open on my laptop when I woke up in the morning was, I had Googled what is the longest page on Wikipedia. And I wish I knew why.
Well, I want to know which one it was now.
Shall I find out? Let's have a look. Oh, my goodness. Joe Biden's 2020 endorsements.
Thank you.
That is random.
Is that the longest page?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Number two was the timeline of historical geopolitical changes, which you would expect perhaps would be first. And number three... list of fatal dog attacks in the United States.
That is so bizarre.
Like historical geopolitical events, that makes sense to me. Joe Biden's 2020 endorsements and dog attacks in the United States. I wouldn't have put those in the top 100, I don't think.
No, no. We would have lost all of our money had we bet on that.
Well, now we know. When it comes up in a pub quiz, we will know the answer.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Let's try something new. I've had an idea for a new segment for the podcast, and it involves you. Introducing listener voicemails. Go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail and leave me a brief recording to play on future podcast episodes. Let's have a go and see how it works. Let me know what you're thinking at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/voicemail. So, having talked a bit about the trauma aspect of the study, it would be good to look at the environmental side of it. So, people who hoard often cite not wanting to damage the environment by not recycling everything or by throwing things away, knowing they'll go into landfill. And this sounds laudable, but it's applied in a misguided way, and it is disproportionate. And there's also cognitive dissonance if we don't want anything to go into landfill, but we are also buying stuff. So that's why I said it's not a simple relationship earlier. But keeping everything in your house doesn't save the environment. Do you think there could be a particular connection between this focus, this environmental focus in hoarders and trauma, abuse or grief they've experienced?
Yeah, I mean, what she talked about there, just the idea that recycling everything will kind of be some sort of panacea to the problems of the world. I mean, reduce, reuse, recycle, it comes last. It's about the reducing and the reusing that are going to help the environment. And recycling is not particularly efficient. It's one of the more difficult things to reconcile. And as you said, not buying as much and attempting to reduce waste is much more effective. And by the way, just keeping it in your home is not reducing waste. For me, recycling is a way to assuage my guilt for my perceived mistakes that I've made. And it all kind of comes back to that. Unfortunately, that moral satisfaction we get from recycling doesn't equate with the environmental benefits. And I think this is the connection. Often those I work with kind of describe that they imagine their possessions in the tip, you know, the seagulls flying over and the smell, and just feel unable to let something that they've used or previously loved go. They see it as being disloyal, cruel, exploitative to belongings like others have been to them. So that projecting their own thoughts and feelings onto their possessions, animals, living things, I think that's the link. I also think there could be possibly some assignment of environmentalism as kind of a reason, you know, reason giving for the person who's looking for answers as to why they find it difficult to let go. Well, I have this value and I have this, you know, trauma background and this empathy for living things. So that must be why. That must be the reason behind me not being able to let go. But I do think it is that I've made mistakes. I've bought these things. If I just recycle it or I donate it or I give it to someone who's worthy, then I will no longer feel that moral shame of not being able to manage my consumption and live in a way that feels, yeah, in a way that's functional, really. I think that is where the link comes in, and it's that whole perfectionism and fear of making mistakes that makes us want to try and make up for it in the discarding process. But I've just been through my own little reorganizing process in the last couple of weeks, and I've walked the walk, and I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling a lot of empathy for people I work with and how hard it is to let go of things. Once they are in your home and they've been there for a period of time, it's very difficult to let them go.
It is.
Boxes. Boxes are my thing. Boxes are my kryptonite. I had every box from every device I had ever purchased back to the early 2000s, and I'm not exaggerating, in pristine condition, mind you, underneath the stairs, all beautifully.
Yeah.
I pulled all of them out and I gave myself permission to let them go into landfill because, you know, the pieces that could go into recycling went into recycling, the pieces that were plastic, etc. I had the hard rubbish collection come and I felt terrible seeing all of my items out there on the street. But I knew that I needed that space for new things to come into my home, for things that, you know, I'm decluttering my mum's house. So now there are things, you know, that have come from her home that I want to keep. I need to make room for those and I can't have everything. I can't keep everything.
And those things exist. And so the difference is, do they exist in the cupboard under your stairs or do they exist in a landfill? Like, the, where they are makes no difference to the fact that they are either going to landfill or recycling or whatever. They're already in existence. There's nothing we can do about that now. And so the decision is, do you feel some misguided responsibility for keeping hold of it forever or not? Because the thing is, well, there's two things. Well, there's many things, but I'm going to talk about two. One is that much as it's great to be diligent about recycling, what I could do in a lifetime of recycling is eclipsed by what Nestlé produces in an hour, in a minute, probably. It's eclipsed by one person with a private jet taking one journey. And that's not to say we shouldn't try to do it. It's not to say it's a waste of time. I'm not being fatalistic about it. But also, the future of the world does not depend on every piece of paper in your house going into recycling. Sometimes they just go in the bin, and that is okay. The other point I want to make about it, and this is a difficult one, but I'm all about being honest about this stuff. Sometimes we put something down to environmental concerns because that sounds better than I just want to keep it. And we kind of retcon and go, yeah, I kept that because I want to save the earth. And I'm not saying we don't, I am very concerned about the environment. I'm not saying it's all a lie, but I am saying that it's not impossible that sometimes it's a justification rather than an authentic reason to keep something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that well, I feel upset about it, so and that must be my values around being environmental. That must be it, you know. And it's just that reason giving when really it's I just can't reconcile letting this go for whatever reason it might be. And it chances are it's not whether you have thought about it going to landfill. It's more, it's kind of more emotionally connected than that.
Yeah.
But we don't really want to think about that because it's too hard.
Like the environmental damage of phone packaging was done when the phone was manufactured. It was done when the packaging was manufactured. It was done when the phone and the packaging were transported halfway around the world. It was done when it was stored in a vast warehouse for 3 months. It was done when it was then transferred from the warehouse to the Amazon factory. And it was done when Amazon brought it to you. What actually happens to the cardboard box at the end is not the environmental concern in that equation. But we like to think we have some control over the world. And so we like to believe that if we just recycle the box, or keep the box, then the rest of it is okay. But that damage is done long before it's in your hands.
Yeah. Yep. And we're better off not upgrading our phone every time a new version comes out or, you know, attempting to find other solutions to cleaning products that are, you know, that are really reducing waste. those are the things that we need to spend our time on. Mind you, we haven't discussed the whole privilege element of being environmentally...
Massively.
Yeah, sound is so hard. I mean, you need to have money in order to be able to make these decisions about buying less wasteful products. It's unbelievable.
An ex-girlfriend of mine worked in a homeless shelter and then, in a twist none of us expected, got a job with an oil company. And the interesting thing was, I remember her saying, like, when I worked at the homeless shelter, all my shopping had to be the real basics, regardless. Now I work at an oil company, I can afford to buy the eco thing, and it's a reality that they are never or rarely the cheapest option. If your approach in the supermarket is the cheapest toilet cleaner, the cheapest potatoes, the cheapest whatever, through necessity, then you can't buy the ones that are maybe not, that they're not, it used to be that they were miles more expensive. I don't think that's necessarily the case now, but still it doesn't matter. You know, if you can't really afford it, you get the cheapest one.
And no, that's right. It could mean the difference between, you know, having an item and not having it.
Yeah, I resisted driving for years and years and years for the environmental reasons. I couldn't justify it, and I live in a city with, well, that had decent public transport and all of that. I couldn't justify having a car myself. And then some circumstances changed that meant I really needed one, and I felt very, very guilty about that. And then I learnt that a car, more damage is done to the environment manufacturing a car than it will do in the rest of its life. The damage a car does when you drive it is a fraction of the damage. So I just figured, if I always buy, you know, if I don't buy a brand new car, then I felt better about it. And that's not to say, you know, we should all therefore get cars if we've been putting it off, or that it's all fine. It's not all fine. But again, it's about it, when you start looking at proportions and how much difference me using eco-friendly kitchen spray makes compared to, sometimes we put a lot of effort and money and time into things that barely make a difference, and then we carry on getting Amazon deliveries daily or you know, whatever it is that is actually doing proportionally far more damage.
And we also often make compromises for functioning, right? Like you were talking with Casey Davis about, you go, well, this isn't, you know, I need this for me to be able to function. I'm happy to forgo whatever, you know, benefit to the environment, but I need this and I need it now. And so we forgo for functionality. And I think that's one of the things that is hard for people who hoard to kind of grasp. And also, I think there's some sense of accomplishment of being able to get by, to manage in less than a optimal way, because then you feel kind of, I don't know, like you're making do, and you feel like you've got that kind of self-efficacy. I can do this. Make do and mend, you know. And sometimes it's just, you know, it's not working. It's not helping you function. It's not allowing you to move forward.
And sometimes, like in my recent experience, having used eco toilet cleaner for years And then I ran out and I thought, oh, just once, I'll stick some bleach down there. It'll be fine. And I kind of did a silent little apology to the waterways as I sprayed bleach into the toilet. And then the next morning I was like, it sparkles.
Do you know you're the second person who has told me that story in a week, can I say, about putting bleach down their toilet and going, wow, it's so clean. Unbelievable.
And so now I'm alternating now. Like I will use Eco for a bottle, and then when that runs out, I will use bleach for a bottle. And that's not great, but equally, it's nice to feel like your toilet's really clean.
Yes.
So some people listening will think that's horrifying. Others will think I've never used anything but bleach, hadn't even occurred to me. And all of that is okay because we're all doing our best, right?
Exactly. We're all doing as much as we possibly can.
And sometimes our best isn't perfect.
Yeah. And you're probably the same as me. You sort of stand at the bin and you put something into the rubbish. I call it the rubbish.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of paper, you know, and you're so tempted. And I often will pull it out and put it into the recycling.
Because that one bit of paper will make all the difference.
All the difference. And I had a client when I was training, you know, like to be a counsellor. And that was that she saw me put something into the bin and then pull it out and put it into the recycling. And she said, oh, see, you know how you were talking to me the other day about perfectionism and, you know, letting things go? Maybe you should just let that go in the normal bin. I was like, wow, it is just this sense of, you know, perfection. I can't make a mistake. I must follow the rules.
There's a realization I've been having about myself over maybe the last 6 months, is that I realized that if I think of a plan related to de-hoarding and then I extrapolate it in my head and realize it won't work in the long term, then I write it off. And so so one example of that is I thought maybe I can create a habit where every day a bag leaves the house. Maybe just daily a bag goes to the bin or to the charity shop or whatever. And then I thought, yeah, but if it's snowing and icy, I won't be able to stick to it. And then use that initially as like, so therefore that plan won't work. And I saw that thought process. I kind of watched it go by and thought, that is ridiculous. So then I was like, well, you could have a plan where every day something goes out unless circumstances don't allow it. And it was quite a shift for me to go, oh yeah, so I could have a plan for some of the time. Like, and also I would go, well, I've got this great idea and I'm going to do it. And then I would think, yeah, but often I have these great ideas and it only works for a bit. Whereas I used to go, it will only work for a bit, so there's no point doing it. Whereas now I go, I'll do it until it stops working, at which point I will come up with a new thing.
Totally. Oh, my God. I've had that very conversation with myself so many times.
Since I've become aware of it, I've become a lot better at challenging it. But I wonder how many plans I've dismissed because when I mentally extrapolated it into a hypothetical future, it might not work if I hurt my back. Like,
yes, the randomest sort of circumstances. You go, oh, well, that means it won't work. Yeah. And the same for, oh, you know, when you're thinking about letting something go, oh, but I might need it if the world stops spinning and I become the Queen of England. Oh, okay. Well, I'll keep it.
Exactly. And so similarly, you can go, I'm going to recycle as much as I can. But if the odd bit of recycling gets in the general rubbish, in the rubbish, that doesn't mean the entire plan is scrapped. It just means a bit of recycling ended up in the general rubbish. That's all it means.
That's all it means. Yeah, it doesn't have a bigger impact on the wider world if I put a piece of paper in the rubbish and not in the recycling.
Yeah.
Boom.
Visualize that Nestle factory and realize.
Yes, I think that is a really good thing to kind of visualize and go, okay, well, there's all these massive organizations who need to lift their game. I'm doing my bit. I'm doing as much as I possibly can. And yes, I occasionally make mistakes, but they're not, the Exxon Valdez disaster, or they're not,
Exactly.
It is the proportions are what's off, isn't it? As you said earlier, it's that disproportionate emphasis on our tiny little contributions that we make. We really need to put them into perspective.
And it's important that we state that adverse childhood experiences possibly leading to more socially responsible behavior as adults does not mean that that justifies trauma. It doesn't mean that we can say, oh, well, it's not so bad that these terrible things happened to me because I turned out a better person. I think at best we can say at least one good thing came from it, but even that is a push. But more than making us more empathetic and compassionate, trauma makes us miserable and stressed and suicidal and ill and angry. So we need to be clear that we're not even hinting at trauma not being as bad if we end up being good people.
No, certainly not. No, recovery from trauma is much more complicated than that idea of what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I think that's kind of the idea of the post-traumatic growth sector, that large field of study that emerged in the 1990s. That's just the idea that recovering from life-altering negative events can lead to positive transformations in values, actions, and relationships. It doesn't take away from those negative things that have occurred. Starting a charity or becoming an advocate, volunteering, writing a book, those things might happen, and they might also be healing for you. I've observed in a number of hoarding clients that extreme level of empathy towards living things as a result of great interpersonal trauma, from the tiniest of insects and animals to plants and then the broader environment. And this uber empathy stops many of them from moving forward. So that idea that the empathy is a wonderful balm or solution, these people empathize with every tiny creature and can't create a life for themselves. That is not necessarily improving their life. And that uber empathy can be quite debilitating.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what can we, as hoarders and as people who support or love hoarders, what can we take away from this research?
I think one of the things that I really feel about this is that your experiences have shaped how you perceive the world and those in it. You might be distrustful of people and this stops you from connecting. And I want you to know that there are trustworthy people out there who want to connect with you. It's great to have animals and maybe a soft toy to cuddle when you feel alone, but more is not better. You can't rescue everything. Saving the world one object at a time will not save you. And I've mentioned this before, I think, but empathy is stepping into another's shoes and feeling, thinking, experiencing what they're going through. But compassion is taking the perspective of that other person, animal, living thing, understanding it and wanting to help. That's additional. We need compassion for others and turn that compassion inwards. Talk to yourself like you would a close friend, a child, a butterfly, I don't know. But practicing self-compassion by externalizing your inner radio doom and gloom will improve how you interact with the world. Give your mind a name like mine's Gloria. Sometimes she's hurtful. I just make sure I put her in her place. But you are worth saving, just as worthy as our environment, just as worthy of love as those bugs, plants, animals in your backyard. You can receive love as well as give it. And that's what I want you to take from this research and from this podcast.
Amazing. I love it. So, Jan, if people want to find you online, where can they do so?
On Instagram, Twitter, I am at @stuff_ology, or you can cruise over to Facebook, Stuffology Consulting. Give us an email, jan@stuffology.com.au. Always love to hear from you. And I've had some great feedback lately for the newsletter. So go to my website, stuffology.com.au, sign up, and you'll get a little bit of a gem in your inbox weekly. It's all free.
Love it. Thank you, Jan. Always an amazing contribution. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me yet again.
Do you want to be a de-hoarding darling? You can be now at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. If you love the podcast and want a bit extra, you can finally sign up to subscribe. Members will get an exclusive monthly post with an additional top tip, some podcast and music recommendations, and a personal update from me about how things are going. Find out the full details at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/darling. In this week's top tip, Mindy Weinstein is talking on the Everyone's Talking Money podcast, and she's talking about FOMO, which is fear of missing out, and about regret. Have a listen.
So where I'm going with this is that knowing that FOMO well drives some of your purchase decisions or desires to purchase, also at the same time know that we've seen through psychological research that our anticipation of regret, which is really, you know, goes with FOMO, it's very short-lived. So even though you might be fearful of missing out on that deal or that product, you're probably not going to feel that way for a long time. It's actually going to go away pretty quickly. So we've seen that like potential regret that we might experience is very short-lived. So knowing that is really important. So like, and I have to tell myself these things. So what we're talking about, I do the 24-hour for myself. Like, do you really need that? And then I'll ask, you know, is this bringing value? Is it something that I needed anyway? And then also, is it a fear of loss that is driving me? And then if it is, well, I have to understand that that's going to go away. I'm not going to feel FOMO down the road. So that's just a huge part of scarcity.
That's good to know, isn't it? That if you stick with wanting it, stick with the feeling of FOMO, sit it out, it will reduce and go away. I am going to aim to see if that helps me resist things. Okay, thank you for listening, and I will speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to the Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder podcast. You can find more online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at That Hoarder and on Facebook at Overcome Compulsive Hoarding with That Hoarder. To find out more about how you can support the podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support and do subscribe to the podcast to make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you ever make a purchase through the links, and it helps to support the future of the podcast.